Hey guys, welcome to Cup of Connections. I'm Portia, and we're here coming to you from our virtual cafe, Better with a Cup of Coffee. We are savoring relationships with coffee lovers around the world and sharing their experiences that have been better with a cup of coffee.
I have Michael Harwood, the co-owner of Vignette Coffee Roasting in Greensboro, North Carolina, my hometown, for part two of our episode. I just couldn't do one episode with Michael. I had to do a part two. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me back. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you so far. And I can't wait to see what we get into going forward.
Awesome. I wanted to share with the audience because it is getting cooler. So a lot of times people will go to a warmer drink. But I love when I took the class with you. And one of the questions was that I wanted to know about cold brew versus just throwing some ice in some coffee. Explain to the audience about the differences that maybe a lot of consumers don't know.
Yeah, that's a great question because iced coffee is dominating the market right now. This is a wild change from, I would say, even 10 years ago in my service experience where almost everything was hot. You know, in the summer in North Carolina, obviously we'd make a lot of iced Americanos, which is espresso and water and ice. And I felt like an iced Americano machine in July and August, but the rest of the year, you know, it was mostly hot drinks. And nowadays, if you look at Starbucks numbers, I think it's like two out of every three drinks they sell is iced. So it's a very, very surging subsection of our menu. And it's something we've thought a lot about. And so what are the differences when you see iced coffee versus cold brew versus iced latte even? I think most people know what an iced latte is, but just to kind of get that one out of the way, double espresso typically, your choice of milk, ice, stir it up, nice and refreshing. You add some flavors to that, good deal. All right, so that's the iced latte. And latte literally means milk, I believe in Italian, so you kind of get that it's going to be a little more milk heavy. So that's an espresso base typically. Then you get into iced coffee. And it depends on tradition here what kind of iced coffee will be presented to you. In many cases, iced coffee might be a hot brewed coffee, let's say on a batch brewer, like an auto dripper at home, like a Mr. Coffee or something like that. And people will brew it hot, just normal ratio, and then stick it in the fridge and cool it down. That can be okay, but the reason why the industry has moved away from that a little bit is that when you brew coffee hot, one of the beautiful things about hot coffee is that it's got all these volatile aromatics. And when you grind coffee, you smell it. When you brew a fresh hot coffee, you smell it. That operative word volatile means they're escaping. They're fleeing into the atmosphere. So when you brew hot and then ice it, it's not that it will be bad. It just loses a little bit about what makes it spectacular when it's fresher. So there are still cafes that do that. And honestly, as far as a value brew for iced coffee, it's pretty good. You do want to watch out on how long you keep that around for. I would say maximum 24 to 48 hours, and then it's going to start tasting not so good on you. That's also one reason why people move to something called cold brew. Cold brew, instead of brewing with hot water, you're brewing with room temperature water typically. Water right out of the spigot. It's also typically made much stronger in that we call it a concentrate, whereas a hot cup of coffee is going to be brewed for about one part of coffee, 16 part water. Cold brew can be as brewed as strong as one part coffee to four parts water. So four times stronger sometimes. And now you have a concentrate that is steeped overnight. It's anywhere somewhere between 12 and 20 hours is what most cafes brew their cold brew for. So because you're not brewing with hot water, you lose that energy with it being cold water. So you need time to make up for it.
Ah.
Yep. So that's the little tidbit of why they're so different functionally in terms of brewing. And then the outcome of the brews is also different. So iced coffee is going to be like a hot coffee cooled down, a little more silky, a little more delicate nuance in flavors, and a little more full range in that acidity and bitterness and sweetness that you can get from a hot coffee, just depending on what the roast level is, the extraction, all that. Cold brew is a little bit different in the cup because you're not using hot water. You're not unlocking so many of those acids and bitters typically. What you tend to get is a little bit more of smooth, sweet, balanced experience. But because it's brewed stronger, the concentrate is going to be hefty. It's going to be weighty. It's going to have a lot of body. So what most people do is they brew that concentrate and they keep the concentrate in the refrigerator, which when you have a cold brew concentrate, remember I said the hot coffee cool down lasts about 24 hours, maybe 36, 48 hours.
Right.
Cold brew left as a concentrate, as long as there's no bacteria or whatever introduced to it, it can stay in your fridge pretty well up for 2 weeks. Some people do it even longer. It's really interesting though, because once you add water to that concentrate to make it ready to drink, RTD, it lasts about 48 hours again.
So wait a minute, is that why you would typically add water when you're pouring the cup?
That's right, at the point of service. That's exactly right. So you get better longevity keeping that cold brew as a strong concentrate, like that 1-to-4 ratio, really, really strong. And it's kind of cool because you have that math, that 1-to-4. And then we know that our hot brew is 1-to-16. So if you think I'm brewing a 1-to-4, now you have four parts to equal that same hot coffee. So if you've got your concentrate, now you've got three parts left. Maybe one part is water, two parts are ice. So you divide your ratios with cold brew RTDing, so to speak, like how you prep your cup, you can divide it into four. So 1/4 concentrate, 1/4 water, maybe 2/4 ice, or maybe you like it more diluted and it's 50% water, 25% ice, 25% concentrate. Or maybe you like yours really strong and it's 50% concentrate, 50% ice. That's how we serve ours here at the cafe. And I always tell people it's going to start nice and strong. And then as that ice starts to melt a little bit, it's going to reach more of that normal strength that you're used to. And so we like to give people just that little bit of extra kick, especially if you're going to put a little milk or cream in it. Having a little higher brew strength does help that coffee flavor carry through. So cold brew, most people know this, but cold brew also, because of its 10 to 20 hour contact time of the grounds in the water, what we call the slurry, is going to have more caffeine per ounce. When you drink cold brew, if you drink, let's say, 16 ounce iced cold brew versus a 16 ounce iced hot coffee cooled down, aka iced coffee, the cold brew will always have more caffeine.
Nice. Yes.
It's made stronger and it's brewed for longer. When you go to the grocery store and you see those cold brew cans, you're getting long steep, overnight steep cold brew typically. So increased level of caffeine in those cans that do say cold brew.
That is so cool. See, I told you an array of information and knowledge. Being in the coffee industry, it's not for everyone. It's quite challenging. If you were speaking to a group of people or a person who wanted to get into the coffee industry and wanted to make a living out of it, and it's specifically being a coffee roaster, what would you tell them? Be honest too.
Yeah. So number one, being a coffee roaster is going to be a very, very different job than being a barista. And a lot of younger people who are very excited about coffee, and this is no slight, being enthusiastic about something and caring about something is a beautiful thing. But when you are a barista and you think you want to get in the world of roasting, there's a gut check that I like to give people. Roasting is an amazing job, but it's very different than service work. Here's the nitty gritty. Green coffee bags come in at 150, 152, 154 pounds. So it can be a physically demanding job. Mandy is pretty strong. As a longtime coffee roaster, you know, you might look at Mandy and think that person's kind of like average build, but she picks up a bag and hoists it over her head, throws it over her shoulder, and you're like, how'd you do that? So you're on your feet 8, 10, 12 hours a day. the bagging, labeling, printing of labels, adhering of stickers is both tedious and requires extreme attention to detail. It is work that not everybody is cut out for. So there is an attention span that is required for a job like that while you are being physically, you know, demanded of. That takes kind of a unique personality. And here's the biggest difference between being a roaster and a barista. With a barista, you spend all day listening and having dialogue with people. A roaster, on the other hand, is a very different experience, generally speaking. It's rather isolating work. And so people who make that transition from the bar to the roaster, number one, you don't want them to make that direct jump. Usually what you want to do is open up the roastery, invite them in to help with production, start learning the ropes of how you build bags and the sequence that we're filling bags and labeling and everything. You know, is that interesting at all to you? Is that, you know, something you can handle? Learning to crawl before you can walk, I think, is really important in gaining that understanding and perspective on it. And then by the time you're ready to roast, you have that discipline. So not to say that we don't train on the roaster for younger folks or that you couldn't get a taste of it, but there's a world in which you have to kind of learn that approach, because if you just dove right into doing everything, you'd be overwhelmed and be like, wow, this is kind of a tough job. In my experience, it takes a very specific kind of mindset and person. People who are very dedicated to coffee, number one. Number two, introverts tend to do well as roasters because you're not spending a lot of time socializing.
Mm-hmm.
Any roaster that had a lot of time to socialize, it'd be like, is your roaster on autopilot? Or like, you know, what are you doing exactly with the
adjustment?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, seriously, like when Mandy is roasting, the focus on her face and just like her level of like being in that bubble, it's remarkable. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know better than to go in there and ask like frivolous questions, especially during certain parts of the roast. There's kind of like a hurry up and wait aspect to roasting, where certain parts of the roast are easier to manage, and other parts it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, like a lot of stuff is happening very quickly, and it's really important that you make good decisions in those moments. So
it's so interesting, because when I did an interview with an owner, he was from Boone, North Carolina, and it was quite interesting how he said, you know, I'll be honest with you, there are more roasters here than there are coffee shop owners, like just coffee shops that sell coffee and they don't roast. So is it a lucrative business? I've always been intrigued by that. Like, is it a good business to start?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it largely depends on what do you want to be doing? What's your experience in? I mean, again, they're very different skill sets. There's some overlap, but again, I am more the retail person and roasting is not my expertise. Whereas Mandy can actually do both. I mean, she's very talented. So she can do both, but most people cannot. Like they have one area of expertise or the other, because coffee sort of demands that at a higher level that you kind of bring mm-hmm. that focus to it. The economics of cafes are difficult between wanting to pay your people more, wanting to do any kind of benefits for your people, wanting to keep prices low enough so that they're accessible. A lot of retail owners are between a rock and a hard place. And so they're looking to help their margins wherever they can. And that is where I believe your other interviewee was noticing more cafes are starting to self-roast. It is not the majority by any means, but I think we're the only concept in Greensboro, for instance, that does roasting and serving in the same space. So there are a couple of roasters that have a roastery in a warehouse and then have a retail space elsewhere, which is a little more common. And then the most common is to just have a retail space and it's just a one-off independent cafe, or maybe you develop enough success to open a second and a third. So I think the reality most cafe owners would find is that unless you are in a very highly trafficked area, like let's say a larger city that's got great pedestrian traffic, you're probably not going to make a whole lot of money off one cafe. That's just the reality. Now, I know there's people out there who have figured it out. And what I think you would find with a lot of those spaces is that they increase their average ticket with having a bit of a market aspect, which is great. Nothing wrong with that.
What do you mean by that?
Having other products to sell, like locally crafted products, you know, like encouraging that community aspect of like local jams, jellies, crafty, you know, wood stuff, you know, local t-shirts, bags, you know, barbecue stuff, all that stuff. More successful cafes may also have some kind of food program. This raises a lot of questions about like work culture, who's doing what, who's getting paid what, are there systemic biases at play and who's front of house versus back of house. It's kind of wild, actually, how much opening a food program in a cafe reveals some of the negative aspects of our society. But that said, you need something other than just the margin you're getting on the coffee, unless you're going to sell a lot of coffee. And that is because even though coffee has a decent margin, its absolute margin isn't very good. It's a small amount of money. So you have to sell a lot. Remember how you were saying baristas are always working, hustling. I mean, that's what a good cafe needs to survive, is that kind of flow. Or you have very low overhead. You know, you have some kind of like sweetheart rental deal. You know, you're keeping your costs down. One of the things that we try and do with our wholesale partners is that even though we put a premium price on our coffee, because we're paying farming producers that premium, like we're paying better for coffee, right? So our coffee is going to cost a little bit more than some companies, but we're trying to bring value through shared preventive maintenance, you know, keeping you up and running, decreasing waste, having better dial-ins, better quality, and all those things factor in because it's your core product to bringing you more revenue, decreasing your loss. So like we can help on those margins. And I think a good coffee shop owner has got to understand those things to be successful. It's not about like micromanaging your employees so much, but like setting some expectations about dose, waste, quality, all these things and following through on them. So compare that to a roastery where it's a lot of hard work to get it set up. There is higher costs involved to start a roastery, like significantly higher. Because a roaster itself can cost $30,000 to $50,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, a brand new espresso machine can cost a good bit too. But, you know, you can typically find a used espresso machine or a lower cost espresso machine to get you going.
There are certain areas, right, where you as a coffee business, like, you know, the ins and outs of specific companies that sell these products at a lower cost, right? I mean, do you have specific places where you guys go?
For our goods, right now, we're not buying in bulk for much, but like our bags per se, we have a supplier called Tricor Bronflex. They're a US company. They're great to work with. And our bags are all compostable as a result based on the material. It's called BioTree. That's why we went with them. It's one of our values, is to reduce our waste and impact where we can. So that is one thing that kind of helps us keep our costs down as we work with suppliers like that. We do support local, like all of our groceries, or I should say probably 95% of our groceries come from Deep Roots Co-op here in Greensboro. We are a member of the co-op. Wherever I've lived, I've always found value in what a local co-op brings to its community because it supports local farmers. There's usually good food subsidy programs at co-ops. They make it easy to donate to those programs, which is a good thing. Again, that kind of like pay as you can model a little bit, where neighbors are supporting neighbors. And what you will find, I think, is most cafes probably end up trying to find purchasing efficiencies from places like, you know, restaurant store, or, you know, things that require like an initial membership, often at low cost, but will give you access to more like wholesale pricing on things. Our economy is largely based on quantity, making things more affordable, right? And we kind of go against that in craft coffee. Like, we're kind of like, hey, take this micro lot, take this smaller lot, you take this family sized farm. So that is part of our value, but certainly a responsible cafe owner or roastery owner will have to find some cost efficiencies unless their market can bear higher prices. Otherwise, your profit margin is not going to be there. And you know, you can get by on a little bit less, but at a certain point, it's not going to be sustainable for the business. Mm. So that's the million-dollar question, is like, can you sustain it? It's pretty low success rate from what I understand. Mm. And having done this for a year, I can see why. Mandy and I are in a unique position to be able to focus exclusively on our business and support each other. And we're very, very fortunate that we can do that. But for people who have families or other important needs, loved ones in their life that they have responsibilities. So, I mean, giving as much of yourself as this is can be hard. And honestly, nobody should be forced to work this much to make ends meet. We're just doing push that ball up the hill and make it so that we get to that sustainable point. And then we can hire, be good leaders, and provide for our workforce in a way that we had always hoped that we would be treated, and in some ways have received good treatment, but just looking to make it even better as we go forward.
I think one of the things that you had mentioned to me when I visited, and I wanted to make a point of mentioning it, was when I was talking about the type of coffee that I wanted to incorporate into my business, you were asking me a series of questions, but then you also said something key. You said you have to get the coffee in the right season too. And didn't you say that, you know, a lot of people don't focus on the season. If you want, say, if you're a business and you want Colombian coffee, or you want Brazilian coffee or Guatemalan coffee, sometimes they just get the coffee. But your emphasis was you have to buy during the right season. And that is a full circle coming back to the consumer, which a lot of consumers don't realize, that you and other people like yourself, professionals, educators, is that getting it the right season gives you a better cup.
You're getting more value for right. your dollar. And ultimately, there can be a lot of pretension in craft coffee about flavor notes and all this. But earnestly, we feel like you getting more bang for your buck is a big thing that we're after. You know, we feel like people have been a little taken advantage of in coffee and other foodstuffs for a long time because there's not necessarily the education out there.
Do you mean the consumers being taken advantage of?
To a degree. Oh. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I mean, I would say the farmer producer as well. I mean, the middle people of that chain, you know, specifically the roasters, I feel like in many instances, we're just kind of like, who cares about it? Quality, whatever, we'll just put a price point on it. You could argue that when it was like really affordable, maybe there was some value in that, although not for the farmer, I can assure you. These days, taking everything into account, the whole custody chain, you know, prices have to be higher to honor where that coffee's provenance is, who grew that coffee, all the people that picked that coffee, processed it, got it to you. It's not a good look for the roaster to be greedy and take advantage of the farmer producer and then the end consumer and say, I'm going to buy the cheapest I can. Who cares about the quality at the end stage? You're going to drink it regardless. So that's not a good deal for anybody. It's going to result in really dark roasting, and that dark roasting is only going to paper over defective coffee that has boozy flavor, or it could taste like Band-Aids, or really, really funky, bad flavors. And it's not sustainable for producers. We've seen a generation of farmers' children move to cities, just like we did in the States, right? Because better jobs were in the cities. Why stay out on the farm? Well, let's give an incentive. Better coffee, which takes more work. It absolutely takes more work to produce better coffee, a lot more. Not just more work, but more attention, more care. Somebody who really knows what they're doing.
And that's why buying in the right season, you were telling me, is so important.
Buying seasonally honors that level of work that's going on Because if I buy 100 bags of coffee here for our roastery just to get a volume discount on it, and I'm selling you that coffee 2 years from now because it was cheap for me, now your coffee is going to taste like cardboard and wood and stale. And you might be like, I'm a bad home barista. I don't know how to brew coffee. And it ain't you. It's the roaster taking advantage of you. So, you know, it is hard to buy 100% seasonal, but it is a worthwhile goal. And I say it's hard because you try and buy the right amount for maybe 2 to 4 to 6 months. So you're projecting how much you're going to use. Sometimes you're selling more than you thought. Sometimes you're selling less. So it is hard. I'm not saying it's easy for any roaster, but doing your best to keep coffees coming in fresh will be a better value for your guests, for your wholesale partners, for the people coming in your cafe. And what we also try and do is, again, just open that door and say, this is one of the reasons why this coffee smells so vibrant, why it's got sweetness and body for days, because this coffee is only 4 months off harvest. You know, it just came in last week. So in that Northern Hemisphere versus Southern Hemisphere dividing line is really what's telling us where to buy. Countries in the Northern Hemisphere, like Mexico, Costa Rica, Ethiopia, Sumatra, they may be pretty close to the equator, but they're still north of it, which means that their coffee is being harvested around our winter holiday season. And then it's going to take a couple months, maybe 2 to 3 months, to process that coffee, to dry it, to rest it. And only then is it ready to package and ship in those 150 pound bags that are usually a Grain Pro liner to keep it smelling great, to keep weird smells and moisture out, to keep air out. And then you've got that natural fiber bag we often see as jute fiber or sisal, which are very renewable, affordable resources in many origins around coffee, and they make great liners. So you've probably seen those jute bags make great handbags and recycling those, upcycling those. Gardeners can find uses for those. So again, just upcycling, reducing waste. But seasonality is paramount here. And I know you love the Brazil in the nightshade. So that Brazil goes away for a few months and then it comes back because it's on a seasonal cycle. So although we don't have the Brazil in the nightshade all year, we try and keep it around for a chunk of the year. And then in the months it's not there, we substitute it with another lower elevation, rich, full-bodied coffee or two. So that it keeps you coming back and expecting a similar but unique product each time.
That is so interesting that you said that. I never realized why your coffees, like the dark roast that I love, may not be in your shop at that particular season or moment because it's not the right season. But then you'll go, oh, that's so neat. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, Michael, where can people find Vignette Coffee? You have your own website. What is the name of the website?
Yeah. So if you just go to vignettecoffee.com, that's our website. So that's VIGNETTE coffee.com. And then we have our tasting room here on West Market Street at the intersection with Guilford College Road here in kind of like Southwest Greensboro. So we're here those 3 days a week. We also do classes, as you know, and mentioned.
And if you guys are ever in the neck of the woods, it is not a long drive if you're in Greensboro, and it is worth it because it's an experience. And I think my audience, you know, we're about enjoying stories, kind people, getting more educated about coffee and experiencing different cultures. So I'm grateful for you being on the show, Michael.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Portia White. And I hope you've enjoyed today's conversation. I'd like to give a special thanks to our sponsor, betterwithacupofcoffee.com. If you like what you heard, please rate and review our podcast. And join us again soon at Cup of Connections. Thank you.